Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Hope you've all had a happy Easter. Welcome to election season. This evening I feel a little bit like Jeremy Paxman grilling David Cameron or Ed Miliband. I suspect that might be a bit of a mistake because our guest this evening will probably outwit me very quickly. He hasn't got just one MSc, he's got two MScs, which seems rather greedy to me. I'm here in the lovely Tunbridge Wells in Kent to talk to David Vaux. David Vaux has established himself very quickly in the field of osteopathy and recently authored an article in The Osteopath, the IO's magazine, about focal dystonia in musicians. Let's learn a little bit about David first of all. David, welcome. Nice to see you.
You too.
And welcome to our set.
Thank you.
Tell us to start with, what motivated you? What's got you into osteopathy in the field that you now seem to have arrived at?
I think of a lot of cases of osteopathy or any manual therapy, the field I'm currently in was a bit of an accident working with musicians. A colleague referred a musician to me with the hope that I could offer something that he hadn't had before. And that was about 2 years ago. I started working with a particular musician who was suffering from musician's dystonia. Not knowing much about musician's dystonia, I then started learning more and more about the musical world and that condition. The reason he was, I suppose, referred on to me is because my colleague knew I had an interest in neurology from a sporting background. So I tried to approach it in the terms of learning the language of music, but I tried to approach it in a similar way as I would a sportsman.
And is your own background in sport?
My own background is in the services. Initially I was in the emergency services and both operationally and also had a role in training, which was great because it gave me the opportunity to do further education, looking at physical education within the fire service in particular. But within the postgraduate stuff I did, I was looking at the nervous system and the effects of stress and pressure.
This was before you became an osteopath?
This was before I was an osteopath, yeah. Subsequently then left the services and then became an undergrad at the BSO and went through that training there. From that point, I then decided to do a master's degree in paediatric osteopathy with the Foundation of Paediatric Osteopathy. And started, and then again, I had an opportunity then to really get to grips with the development of the nervous system and found it fascinating. And I wouldn't call myself an expert.
A specialist?
I wouldn't call myself a specialist in it either. I've got an interest in these things. And I suppose when you have an interest in things, you do a bit more reading. You know, I haven't got a master's degree in neurology. I don't intend to, but I certainly would say I'm interested in it. And I'm quite passionate about using quite simple techniques of neural rehab, I suppose you would say, for everyday stuff as well as more complex stuff. So musician's dystonia, for instance.
Yes, and I interrupted you when you were starting to talk a little bit about that, and you now work at elite level with a lot of people, don't you? You've worked at national level with rugby players, with rowers.
Yeah.
You work now with the English Youth Orchestra. And the article you wrote was about a focal dystonia in musicians. Now, some of our viewers will have read that article, others may not be members of the IO, may not have got the magazine. Mm. So let's run through that. As you said earlier on, you had to look up focal dystonia and musicians' dystonia. Tell us what it is.
I had to look up everything about the musical world, to be honest. I mean, especially the classical musical world. And I was shocked to see that that particular condition affects 1-2% of all professional musicians.
What does it mean?
Well, the best source of information for it is on the dystonia organisation online, and they very simply summarise it as a group of conditions with musical dystonia in particular that affects the ability of the musician to perform the act. Now, they think that it's to do with an adaptation, an unhelpful adaptation in the sensory cortex.
How would it manifest itself in a
so it manifests, way? So for instance, with a string musician, instead of having, or a keyboard musician, instead of having the finite control of your fingertips, which you would expect from someone who's practiced for hours and hours and hours, suddenly instead of being able to do this, then you don't have that control anymore, you're doing that. And they think it's something to do with the sensory homunculus in the brain. The sensory homunculus being the somatosensory and somatomotor cortexes have a virtual representation of ourselves within that. And depending on what you specialised in your life, or what you practice in your life, will dictate what is represented on that map more so. So for instance, with someone who uses their hands more, and this isn't just with musicians, you can also get it in sports as well, something quite focal to a specific task. So for instance, with one of the patients I worked with, he was a wind musician. He had something called ambrosia dystonia, which was again rarer still. And so he had a problem with the raising up of his wind instrument to his lips and not being able to form that seal without having a cervical extension or rotation, which actually made it impossible and ended his career. So that's how it manifests.
All those functions, all those movements individually worked perfectly well, but he couldn't combine them with his instrument in his hands to make it work.
Yeah, it seemed to be the combination. It's that combination that he'd worked on for thousands of hours. That circuit that he'd created, that map, if you like, that he'd created, had become blurred. So if we go back to the finger scenario I told you about, imagine your hand is in high definition. You know, as a musician that uses your hands, your hand is in high definition in the representation in your homunculus. It's in high definition. And then in susceptible individuals, that hand then, instead of becoming high definition, you know, being able to see every detail of that hand, it becomes blurred. So you lose control over it, or the representation of it becomes blurred. So although you do get localized, you know, secondary problems with, you know, muscularity and shortening and loss of range that you'd recognize, the main problem is here. The adaptation, the unhealthy adaptation, the primary adaptation has happened here.
And you said it happens in 2% of musicians?
1-2% of musicians currently, yeah.
Do we know why? Because, of course, it flies in the face of the argument that it takes 10,000 hours of practice to become expert in something. Well, actually, you think the more you did, the less that was likely to happen, wouldn't you?
Yes. I mean, I think generally that intense practice is... It goes into realms of neuroplasticity. It goes into the realms of myelination, which is how we learn skills. And generally, that's a good thing. You practice and practice and practice until something comes unconscious.
I understand as part of that process. Again, sorry to interrupt you.
Sorry.
That you know, as you do more skills, the neural network will develop to make sure that you are better at exercising those fine control skills. How does myelination adapt to practice?
Well, that's inherent in that neural networking. Because the neural network is dependent upon laying down of circuits, and there's a lot of writing out there that describes it as actually laying down a map of movement that is, you know, you've got hundreds of thousands, millions of maps of movement which you learn, and then they become unconscious, and to this point where you don't even think about it. We've got maps that involve me doing this, standing, sitting, talking. Mm-hmm. Any complex skill has more and more maps. And myelination, so for instance, you know, you've learned a new skill, which is to throw a ball, for instance, and you've got a map for that. But within that, you've got, if we want to put it simply, a wire, which has been wired into that that circuitry in your brain. Now that wire, for it to become unconscious and for it to become natural, you have to do hours and hours and hours, thousands of hours of practice. And within that, you have a thickening around that wire or the nerve of the myelin sheath. Right. Now we're probably all familiar with the myelin sheath because of MS. Yeah. And when it breaks down, we have problems. But when we build it up, it's generally a good thing. And that is, you know, a positive form of neuroplasticity. Okay. So with going back to your original question, with susceptible individuals, they seem to have something dysfunctional as opposed to something positive. It becomes negative and you get an overexpansion. So you get, instead of getting the clear defined high definition function of whatever you're practicing on, you get the blurring. And to answer your question, I'm not exactly sure why. I think there's some evidence to suggest that it happens when you are practicing more, or you have a stressful life events or illness. So all these things, I think, what it's suggesting to me is that you have to take a holistic approach and look at what is going on in those people's lives.
What's been the traditional response to it? How have they treated focal dystonia in the past in musicians?
Over time, but generally, if you're diagnosed with it, it basically ended your career, sort of 20 years ago. People have Botox injections to do local numbing and blocking. There's medication. Unfortunately, a lot of the medication is quite heavy and has lots of side effects. Physical therapies are generally advised. Psychotherapists and talking therapies are also advised to deal with the depression and anxiety that comes with it.
So in that sense, they're dealing with a consequence of the dystonia. You just mentioned it actually might be something which precedes or is concurrent with the development of that.
I think possibly. I think with these cases, you've got to really get to know your patient, and that means that you're dealing with generally a bit more of an intense relationship than arguably with your patient than normal, because you really do need to get to know them. I know that we've discussed that a lot of the time, maybe unwittingly, we're doing therapy, although we're not qualified to do it. But in terms of listening, we should be listening and looking, and asking in our histories, you know, what preceded your first symptoms. You know, were there things going on? I'm not saying that it's a main factor in all people, but what I would say is that with sympathetic arousal. Or the fright and flight response, I think that's a massive thing with any performer. Yeah. Certainly with the National Youth Orchestra, I'm currently working to try and set up a healthy musician program for them, which not only looks at things like stretching and warming up and warming down, which hasn't traditionally been part of their world. We're also looking at training their staff into how to recognise anxiety, how to recognise mental and emotional fatigue.
And is this anxiety and fatigue because of their performance, or is this because of something else that's going on in their life?
Well, it could be either. Both? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, who are we to say? But I think anyone who's going to perform at what we would call an elite level can be under lots of pressure. And I think it's good to pay lip service to that. Because when you talk about what predisposes that 1% to 2% of that population, it could be that that's part of it. Certainly, there is some evidence out there to suggest that the normal descending pathways, which can modulate pain, are much less functional if someone is stressed or depressed.
Yeah. It must be quite a challenge working with the National Youth Orchestra, because anyone who's ever been a teenager knows the amount of stress that goes with just being that age, let alone having the stress of performing at an elite level and everything else.
There are those. I mean, it's interesting because I worked in sports and now the arts, and I would say that they are under an incredible amount of pressure to perform. It's interesting because in terms of being judged on performance, a sportsman or a woman may be judged, in training, but when they're looked at generally, it might be a big race or a big game on the weekend which they have to perform at. National Youth Orchestra, when they come together and perform, can perform, 8 or 9 times in a week. And if you're principal violin or principal horn, you have to nail it, because there are 5 or 6 people waiting in line, literally in ranks, in a rank system, to become the first seat. And I think, I didn't know any of this, and I think that I must respect the people who put themselves through that. And again, on a professional level, if you become a professional musician, again, there are people waiting to take your seat. Yeah. And so you've got to nail it every night.
Yeah, you're not a musician yourself.
No.
Right.
No.
Okay.
I wish I was, but no.
Well, take us, I don't want to necessarily recap too long over things that you've already written about in the osteopathy today, but just take us through that process of diagnosis and treatment of your musician there.
So I looked at him. I try to look to him with a backdrop of certain aspects. So I try to look at him with a backdrop of, can I apply something educational? We'll call him Mike for these purposes. So for Mike, can I apply with a backdrop of education? Or can I apply with a backdrop of some kind of sensory intervention? That is including our traditional osteopathic or manual therapy interventions, what I call traditional, as in, you know, active and passive manipulation to the patient. With Mike, what came across very strongly was that there was a psychological component to it, but I think that had come after his diagnosis. I don't think it had ever been adequately explained to him exactly what was going on. So, I mean, I admitted to him that, you know, at this point I wasn't an expert in this, but I certainly had an interest in neurology and had had good outcomes with certain technical aspects of the sporting world. And so I was very open with him. And so with Mike, initially it was educational. It was not your traditional osteopathic intervention, it was educational. And I also, partly for me as well, I had to learn his language, the language of that industry and that world. And subsequently started to look at some sensory intervention. The reason he was, as I mentioned to you, I think, before, the reason he was referred to me is because my colleague knew that I had had some success in rehabbing injured sports people, sort of, you know, the end of their careers and getting them back to, you know, playing, and quite complex cases. And so what I set out to do was approach Michael, not particularly like an injured musician, but as an injured individual, you know, someone who had something that was dysfunctioning. And I tried, although I learnt the language, then to, okay, put that on the side, and then how can I do something that he hasn't had before? And to be honest, that wasn't hard, because he hadn't had a lot of recent intervention. He'd given up hope on playing his instrument again. So as I said, a lot of it was educational to begin with, and then I started to put together a very simple, what I call sensory diet of intervention for him to do daily. And that would initially was very simple movements which started to increase the neural chatter of his movement. Now, you've got to remember with Michael that if he put his horn instrument to anywhere near him, he would have this huge dystonic response, which was still there 25 years later. So that was the problem. The challenge was,
I didn't realise it was 25 years after his diagnosis that you were treating this fellow. So this is a very, very well entrenched reaction then.
Yeah, and challenging. I mean, I'll be honest, at the beginning I thought, I'll give this a go, and I was very open that I'm not sure where this is going to work. So the challenge was, how do you break down this problem, which is not something you see every day in clinic. I hadn't seen this. The problem in there, and then you do this movement. So as an osteopath or a physiotherapist, whatever you do, I suppose what we would all do is try and break it down. And with these cases and with subsequent cases, what I do is I look at, first of all, at the individual, get to know them, get to know their lives, and then look at the actual problem, the mechanics behind what I think is going on here. Why is this dysfunctional neural circuit firing?
Yeah. There's no pain involved in this at the moment, is there?
No, there was some local pain. Right. Okay. In terms of some of the adaptations, I think, that had gone on.
Right. But it makes him an unusual patient, doesn't it? In the sense that most people come, who've got a back pain or a neck pain, and here we've got somebody who's actually got a functional pain, which is a refreshing challenge, I'd have thought.
Absolutely. It was very stimulating. It was very stimulating. And it actually makes you revisit and revise your kind of undergrad neurology and your and what it actually makes you do is try and apply that to different arenas as well, which has been, it was a very, very enriching experience from a personal perspective. Because then you start going into other realms, you can start applying it to really complex cases, you know, of chronic pain. But coming back to Mike, what I broke it down to was looking at the spinal level, trying to look at exactly what was going on with the spinal myotomes and how that related to the myotomes and dermatomes, where that related, if you track it back into the tracts of the nervous system, where that related into the somatosensory and somatomotor homunculus. Mm-hmm. And then try and work towards that accordingly. Now, what researcher did do was that there's a lot of suggestions that if you can increase the neural chatter without triggering a response, and that can include pain, but without triggering, in Mike's case, a dystonic response, then you've got half a chance of defacilitating that dysfunctional pathway. You can't take it away, because once it's there, But what you can try and do is persuade the choice, if you like, of the nervous system to go around that dysfunctional one. To do that, and I've referred to high definition in the past, it's quite a useful analogy to use with a hand. What you need to try and do is turn that dystonic response, that circuit that's not working for him, firstly to black and white, or to colour, then to black and white, then to off, if you can. So you want to try and persuade the brain to switch down a few levels. So that involves trying to calm everything down. So that involves engaging Mike with a process. That involves working with him on a level that he understands, but also on a level that empowers him. So that would immediately get his descending modulatory pathways more likely to work for him.
So in practical terms, that calming down is what he's just, you educating him as to what is probably at this stage going on.
Yeah, and I say calming down, I use that as generally him as a whole and his nervous system, because his nervous system, in terms of when he was approaching to, you know, his horn instrument, he would have a trigger. And so you could argue that his nervous system is in a state of fright and flight. So when I say calming down, I mean him as an individual, but actually his nervous system, you could say his nervous system is him, but on that very specific focal dysfunction, we've got to try and find ways of defacilitating it. Now the way I would try to do it is to very slowly build up levels of complexity with balance exercises, with stuff that closely represented the end result, which was having the instrument there, but didn't quite go there. So to begin with, it was a trial and error. We started out with a toothbrush. You know, it was quite apt because everyone brushes their teeth twice a day. So you didn't ask him to take any time out of his day. And you asked him, I asked him to do quite specific exercises whilst brushing his teeth and whilst focusing on a time in his life when he was able to play. So I'd get him to start using visualization quite early. And that was quite important, to get visualization in there very early. Mm-hmm. We then combine that with motor pathway stuff. So, you know, actually shifting his weight slightly, crossing the midline, which is where I was asking him to pass his toothbrush across, hold it there and pass it across and hold it there, use the opposite hands. Trying almost to increase the neural chatter that's ascending without triggering his response and getting all the time, this is over months and months, but all the time getting nearer to the point where we started to introduce different objects. So mouthpiece to begin with, okay, without the instrument.
But so he can actually carry out the whole movement of having his instrument in his hands as long as it's not got the instrument physically there. So he, the toothbrush, if he's holding that as he would an instrument, he can do that without the dystonic response. And when you introduced the mouthpiece, was that an easy introduction? Did he?
No, that was pretty straightforward. I thought, as you probably did, that might be a trigger, but it wasn't that. So in that respect, it wasn't such an emotional relationship to it. It was more of a neurological relationship. As soon as he caught the actual music, and as soon as he starts to engage with that specific musical circuit is built up over the years of playing, then it triggered it. So in that respect, I had some room to maneuver. I was able to use quite novel methods of getting up and to the point of almost having the wind instrument in his hands. But I didn't want to go there because, as far as I was concerned, the more triggering he had, I wanted to the more he's laying down myelination in an unhelpful way.
Yeah. One of the questions that's come in, and I will get around to asking all the questions if I can during the course of this discussion this evening. I'm just trying to wait for opportune moments to introduce those questions. But the one that's just come in is, how pissed off did Mike get with the length of time that this was taking?
He'd been waiting 25 years. Yeah. So he was okay. He'd stayed in music, mm-hmm. and he'd gone into a more educational role and been very successful. Yeah. But his dream had always been to play again. Yeah. And when we started to have very small steps of change, he didn't mind that it was, and I was very open with him from the beginning, that it isn't going to be a quick thing. You know, the nervous system does not respond quickly. So the answer to your question, he wasn't pissed off. He was actually pretty engaged with it from the beginning. We're both quite pragmatic to begin with. We didn't know where this was going to go. And certainly I tell everyone, that I work with, something similar, that there's no guarantee.
Well, I imagine that, again, I don't want to distract you again from your account there, but it must be very important in cases like this, as it always is, to keep the patient's expectations realistic, isn't it? Because after all, they're potentially going to come and see you on a number of occasions, they're going to pay a significant amount of money, and they've got to know whether there is a strong chance or otherwise of them recovering. And in your case, this is kind of experimental.
It was that was experimental. Yeah. That's the first time I've done that, so by definition. Absolutely.
Yeah. Sorry, so where did we get to with Mike? You were doing your balancing up and building up to the mouthpiece to the lips.
Yeah, wanting to increase the chatter, but not wanting to trigger a dystonic response. Yeah. And at one point we got it up to, because we wanted to try and get the spacing exactly right, so we were doing some very strange things. So at one point he had some kitchen tongs with the mouthpiece, because that represented about the right distance.
Right.
And then he had a shopping bag here with a tin of baked beans in them, because that represented a weight, but it still wasn't quite the instrument. And then we slowly started to introduce the actual instrument and then move it around in novel ways. So first of all, what we decided to do is, instead of getting him to play a few notes even, I got him to use the opposite hand. So he isn't going to actually play any meaningful notes, but the first time he actually engaged with the instrument again, he was using it with the opposite hand. And before he started to actually blow any notes, I got him to be, so this is the mouthpiece. He wasn't quite on it, and he was just blowing through. Again, going as near as he can with the opposite hand, and then we start to alternate that, so then he'd go to the other side with this hand, then going through the motion. So if he had been blowing, we'd been playing. And we'd experiment from time to time, and if he did engage with it, he would have the dystonic response, we'd come away, back away, and we'd spend hours, accumulated to be hours doing that. And it's a great question that came through, because, you know, he had to be engaged with this. Because I got him to do, you know, he's doing that whilst sometimes in front of the mirror, whilst sometimes with the light on, the light out. This is all to kind of try again to use all your senses to increase the chatter in a positive way.
I've been asked to find out whether his dystonic response was the same every time, or did it vary depending on how he approached the mouthpiece, or was it always that same, you sort of turn right and extend?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, it was. Yeah.
And did he see measurable progress over the course of this? Was he able to keep focus? I mean, the prize for him is incredible, isn't it? The idea of getting back to playing an instrument again is a huge prize for a musician.
Mm.
But was he able to see progress throughout all this? Because I imagine that some people would say, well, brushing my teeth while standing on one leg is not necessarily progress, other than the fact that I'm now better at it than I was before. But that's not what I want to do in the orchestra.
Sorry, what was your question? Did he?
Was he able to measure the progress in a way that meant something to him throughout this? I suppose, were you able to communicate that progress?
Yes, yeah, so I certainly.
So this is important.
Yes, yeah. I think, to answer, I don't think he was too sure at points of our interaction. But to give a breakdown of exactly what happened with him, initially, I think there was some quite rapid progress. And I think that was on a level that he was a lot happier, that he felt someone was going to try and help him. Mm. And then we very quickly reached a plateau. And I think what that was a kind of placebo thing happening.
Yeah.
And then we got down to the real nitty-gritty of, this is actually a hardwired neurological thing. And that's when the real work started. But certainly, very subtly, I began to see a bit of progress in terms of, we would occasionally experiment and bring the mouthpiece up, and he'd do a little bit. And he started to do longer and longer without there being a dystonic response. But I'd always ask him to leave it as soon as he started, but it was generally always end with a dystonic response starting. We'd end it there and leave it. And I would time these and film them sometimes as well. And there would be very slow response in the time he could go without having responses. And sometimes, I suppose, if I reanalyzed it and had the time to reanalyze it, I'd look at the time of day, what was going on the night before, what was going on that day, what he had going on, you know, was he nervous about having me in the room? All these things need to be cross-referenced, but you don't have that time as a primary healthcare practitioner, do you? You kind of go with what's working for you at that time.
So how often were you seeing him?
Initially, it was once a week for an hour, for it was 2 months, and then that was quite, generally that's quite intense. There would be weeks when I didn't see him, but I think as we discussed, there would be an interaction in between if it was needed, or if I hadn't seen him, I would look at exactly what he was doing. So he'd have kind of neural homework, so to speak, to do. And if there was a question mark over it, we'd go on online and do video conferencing.
That's quite novel, isn't it?
It's something I believe strongly in, though, that we should be doing. Why not apply our skill set in the digital arena?
Yes.
I've filmed some stuff for some conditioning and injury prevention stuff for a rugby team. It had to be done. The only way I can reach all of them was by doing a film, which I did, and then uploaded, and they all, why not? For me, it's still osteopathy, still applying the skill set in a novel manner, but it's still the skill set. But coming back to Mike, yeah, so we would look at, so we would look online, he'd send me videos, am I doing this right? I could immediately give him feedback if he is or isn't. And also I could note what's happening and note how long it took. So it was really useful.
Just give me a concrete example of what he would be doing online and asking you.
Oh, so he would have, you know, whatever novel method we were trying to do, he'd either, at this point he'd either be presenting the instrument and playing along with the other stuff that made it sort of increasingly difficult for him to do deliberately, of which I'd be aware that week. I'd be aware of what he was doing that week, and I'd look at what he was doing and then correct it if necessary.
So he wasn't able to film himself cleaning his teeth on one leg? And
No. I mean, generally speaking, no, I didn't have like cameras all over his house. That's a bit novel.
Yeah.
But I would be looking at specifics. Yeah, I wouldn't be following him or anything like that. So.
Okay. Another question from one of the audience. Is this the same phenomenon as relaxed throat, as in an actor? And apparently this is the original condition treated by Alexander, or the Alexander technique. Do you know?
I would should imagine it's in the same spectrum.
Right.
I certainly know that it's not unique to musicians.
Yeah.
So I've seen it a lot in other individuals I've treated. I've treated some actors and actresses. They haven't actually called it relaxed throat, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Mm-hmm. What were you treating them for?
They would have their own, so for instance, the voice would tremor or wobble at certain points. And in some respects, very similar in that the equivalent of their dystonia would be here.
Right.
Some of them would have a cervical reflex as well with nerves and stage fright.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think in the modern era, we like to put things in compartments and pot them into a label, don't we? But I think, you know, we're dealing with the nervous system.
Yeah.
And there are so many commonalities in this approach that I've applied to other sort of what we would call traditionally complex cases.
Yeah.
That I seem to now see it more as a nervous system which is dysfunctional in some way.
Another of the questions we've had is how you differentiate this, and I'm quoting, this proposed physical etiology from a psychological disorder comparable, say, to PTSD. Now, I don't want to lead you on that because I'm not sure that you would completely disassociate those things.
I wouldn't disassociate anything. Post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, has been in the news a lot recently, quite rightly, and it's interesting because I mention EMDR therapy.
Now, EMDR stands for?
Eye movement.
Yes, we'll look up EMDR. We have an EMDR practitioner in our own clinic. And I can
reorganization.
Remember. Right, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. But certainly, I love the premise behind EMDR therapy.
Right.
Because it's all about crossing the midline, either physically or with your eyes. And they think that why it's so therapeutic is because it similar to REM sleep, where your eyes are moving from side to side, they think that that's a very positive and nourishing thing for the nervous system and therefore for psychological processes. There's an interesting story behind it in that I think the professor who came up with it was having a really bad day. And they'd gone out for a walk after work, and I think it was a windy day. And they're going through all the problems in the mind. when they came back from this walk on a windy day, they said, well, what's happened here? And they started to break down why they were feeling better when they got in from this walk. Oh, a bit of fresh air, etc. But then started to actually investigate it. And the theory was, well, the story goes, I don't know if there's any truth behind it, but I like the story, in that it was a windy day, and she was walking, or I think it was she was walking, and the forest was blowing, and her eyes were tracking the movement. And then that was the start of the theoretical investigation that went into it.
Maybe I'm being obtuse here, but we're forever crossing the midline with our eyes, surely. I mean, you're driving a car, you're constantly looking from left to right and so on. So how does the therapeutic approach differ from just normal life?
I think in that example I just gave you, I think it was because they were intensely thinking about it at the time.
Right.
I'm not an EMDR practitioner, but from what I do understand it is that they actually, with a very skillful practitioner, you go, and I think you have to be a practitioner in your own right to do that. You go and you have therapy, and you revisit those places that are causing you anxiousness and depression.
But I've seen these two were associated when we were discussing this earlier on, but I've certainly seen the beneficial effects of overcoming childhood reflexes, which haven't completely been got rid of in the normal course of events, which our EMDR therapist does as well.
Okay.
And so, yeah, the whole, which is it's a little bit about that crossing the midline, I think, because it's getting away from starfish responses and which all babies have, and using arms and legs properly. But let's stick to something that that you know about, and even if I don't know about it. Next question from the audience: Do you see some of your approaches, particularly the modification of the descending inhibitory pathways, applicable to the treatment of central sensitization? That's a good topic to get onto in syndromes such as fibromyalgia.
Do I think it's appropriate as I do. Simply put, I think that certainly I've applied that principle, the theory that the descending modulatory pathways can be very much working for you. I think the main thing is to accept that if someone is in a state of fright and flight, if someone is chronically depressed, for whatever reason, or anxious, then those descending pathways aren't going to be working optimally for you. In terms of the kind of neural stuff I was describing, I think in isolation it probably wouldn't be effective. I think in isolation, manual therapy isn't effective, but I think taken as a whole, if you combine these things and integrate them together, they can be quite a powerful tool.
I've always connected central sensitization with afferent pathways. So, we discussed this earlier on, we're not going to say sort of neurological detail, but the model that was proposed to me some years back was that when the level of chatter, to use a word you heard earlier on, in the brain is at a certain level, stimuli which would otherwise be unremarkable suddenly provoke a pain response. And I'm bring that up because it did occur to me when you were saying you're trying to raise that level of chatter. That seems slightly contrary to the idea of overcoming central sensitization.
I think if you're raising the level of positive chatter, that is, so you've got to be careful. I've worked with someone who was diagnosed with chronic neuralgic pain. There was no physical reason for it to be there anymore.
Yeah.
And it was then diagnosed that there was probably neuropathic pain. And certainly I applied a similar protocol to should we call her Sue, that I did to Mike. And certainly had some interesting outcomes with her, because the pain initially that was focused around the sacroiliac joint area was show-stopping, really show-stopping, and had been for up to 18 months.
This lady is a sportswoman.
Yes. Yeah. So she was a top-end golfer. Mm. And again, as often happens, I think, she'd ended up, kind of exhausting a lot of what we'd call kind of traditional medical routes, who had done a really good job actually making sure she was okay and managing the pain, but not actually getting to the root of the pain. And certainly the medication she was really having a terrible time on. So again,
and not playing golf.
Not playing golf,
yeah.
Not making a living,
yeah.
And suffering from all the things that you would associate with that.
Yes.
So with Sue, similarly to Mike, you had to kind of get to know what exactly made her tick and what was happening with her in her life. And approach it from a, again, from a perspective is, you know, I approached her from a perspective of looking at what levels do I think that might be sensitized. As you said, you know, what is, how the challenge is, how do you send positive information ascendingly without there being a triggering, you know, closing down that sensitization? It's difficult because if there's been historic pain, you know, the inhibitory neurons, the theory being the inhibitory neurons at a spinal level as well, aren't working well for you. Yes. And so what you've got to try and do is find ways of improving and increasing the proprioceptive input in the ascending pathways. That's what I mean by positive chatter. In such a way that actually what you start to get is the realization at a very local level of the spine that actually it's okay to move, there isn't going to be pain. So with Sue, I started off in a pool, in a swimming pool with a float suit. Because it was the only way really. So with Mike, it was slightly more straightforward because there wasn't a pain, but there was a dystonic response. But with Sue, more or less anything I tried to get her to do which involved that spinal level, when she was weight-bearing, evoked a pain. So that was tricky. So we started in the pool. So float suit on, in the pool, and getting her to go through ranges of motion in there. And we found a few very subtle ranges of motion which weren't triggering that pain. Now, obviously, everyone hasn't got the facility to do that, but we all have got facility to recommend very simple poolside exercises for people to do. I was with Sue at the time, actually, but if someone doesn't want to get in a float suit and be completely unweighted, you can get them just to be unweighted to a point in the pool and go through some very easy and gentle mobilization, which again gets that spinal level working in a non-provocative way. That's what we did initially. So that was water-based. And so with Sue, we started in the water.
What was she physically doing? What was the movement that you were inducing at that early stage then?
Oh, it was quite straightforward. So we obviously I'd assessed her, and you know, anything with any kind of flexion, rotation would trigger an immediate response. So in the water, it was very much less of a response. There still was a response, but less. So we just started with a little bit of flexion, very simple stuff, and some bringing the knee up and they down and doing a in the water, if you like, a virtual kind of squat, which I hadn't been able to do without lots of pain. And we just experimented and played with any movement that I was feeling was getting that area moving. And it wasn't getting it moving for mobility's sake, because there was range there. It was getting it moving for proprioceptive state, but without loading up and triggering the response that was there on land. Now, it took a while to get to the point where we started then coming off, you know, onto dry land, so to speak, and working again in a similar way to we had with Mike. Yeah. So it took a bit longer. But
how do you make that transition from non-weight-bearing, completely non-weight-bearing, to weight-bearing then? Because I presume that, quite apart from anything else, psychologically, she's now back in an environment that she's familiar with and she's expecting that pain response, because this is how I normally...
Yeah. On dry land, so to speak, Sue was still doing some novel exercises in front of the mirror, but we didn't go near anything that I felt was going to trigger the response. I knew it was going to trigger it, and I didn't want to go near that. So, again, breaking it down, we would find things that came up and close to that triggering point, which is different for every case, but we didn't go there. And that went on for some time. That went on for 3 months or so. But from that point onwards, there seemed to be, the pain was there, but it seemed to be a decrease in the quality of the pain. So on a pain scale, it started to come down very slowly, and on a descriptive level, it stopped being show-stopping to manageable, which is quite a big shift. And it seemed, once it changed, to be quite a rapid ability for Sue to then manage it herself. Now, how much of this, again, is placebo, and how much of this is neurological, is open to discussion.
And but in some ways, doesn't matter, does it? Because what you want is a patient back to function. And
Exactly. Exactly. I mean,
it's nice to think that you did it. I know, but you will have done it even if it was placebo.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of, and then there's the nocebo effect as well, isn't it? Which is fascinating. But I think the language we use is important. But I think if, as a practitioner, you know, without the aid of like functional MRI with our patients, what we can do is hope to approach it in a way that makes sense to us. If we go back to ourselves and think, what was my training? You know, how do I look at this person through the prism of my training, and how do I look at this person through a prism of the knowledge that we have now in the modern era, and then try and apply it. As long as you're trying to apply it safely and openly, and doing it in such a manner that you're open about it. And so that there are, with these sort of complex chronic cases of sensitization and pain, I think there's generally room to try. But it's not always the outcome you would want. But I would say that with sensitization, certainly with Sue, there was a big kind of emotional element to it. I did recommend that also that she was having a bit of counselling at the time, and I often like to suggest to my patients that they have a bit of a dual approach. So you have EMDR at your practice, which I think is a great idea actually. I often work hand in hand with a psychotherapist because although you can have fantastic results with psychotherapy and counselling full stop, I don't think you can get as much out of that as you would if you combined it with something manual in terms of physical therapy and movement related therapy, because you've got to take the body along for the ride. You can take, you know, the neurological, the psychological, but you've got to make sure that the body isn't locked in to those movement patterns. Otherwise, I think you can be thinking more positively and be more open, but you're stuck in a kind of response that you're used to.
I've often thought it's one of the limitations of research, because in inverted commas, top quality research, we investigate one intervention and see what it does. But actually, in so many cases, I don't think one intervention on its own necessarily is the answer. And as you're saying here, the two together work much more effectively than the one. And you know, structural treatment, osteopathy or whatever with Sue, had made an improvement, but it hadn't fixed her. Mm. When you incorporate the other therapies, then all of a sudden you get this much greater distance difference. What was the stage at which you introduced exercise which mimicked her sport? Which presumably would be another psychological barrier for her.
Yeah, well, we broke that. That was it was quite early on that once she started to have pain-free movement in the pool, we started to just go movement that mimicked golf swing, etc.
Yes.
In the pool. So it was actually quite early on in the process. It wasn't until, similarly to Mike, with his presenting of the instrument, until quite late on with Sue, that I was confident enough to start just nudging and pushing the boundary a little bit and saying, can we go there yet? Can we go there? And we'd experiment and found that, again, with Sue, that if we did mimic that in a controlled way, the swing or holding a club, if she had a pain response, we'd back away and maybe do something with a training aid which was lighter.
Right.
So you can structure whatever the sport it is or whatever the activity, you can break it down and structure it. So with Mike, for instance, he had a tin of beans and a shopping bag and a pair of kitchen tongs and a mouthpiece. With Sue, she might have had an imaginary golf club. And only gone so far. And I think with both of them, though, the ultimate aim was to get them back to performing that function.
Yeah. You refer in some of your work to Al Lederman's work on functional therapy. And a lot of what you've said sounds contrary to what Ale would have taught, but then my understanding of Ale's work is perhaps not comprehensive. But a lot of it mimics that in the terms of, as you said here, you're mimicking the golf swing, but doing it with no weight, no golf club, small movements and building them up. Have you worked a lot with Ale or studied Ale's methods a lot?
No, I've never met him, but I certainly know that there's some commonality. In that I certainly am attracted to the premise that if you just do passive treatment to a patient, as in we're the osteopath or the physio is doing passive treatment to a patient, I think it can be a bit one-dimensional.
Yes.
I think where you get someone up and engaging with a process of movement, then it's going to be very much more powerful in terms of potential gains. I mean, I believe that the way we learn is, in an evolutionary sense, is by experiencing something, not having something done to us. So if we're trying to do something to the nervous system, something in terms of pain or function, far better to get you up and actually going through movements that maybe slightly mimic it, where you're getting used to that movement and imprinting it again, because that's how we learn. That's how we learn skills. Sometimes it goes wrong, so with dysfunction, but I think to get past the dysfunction, you need to go back to actually how do we learn skills, and I think it's by experiencing them.
But another question is, when Sue or Mike got their undesired response, when she suffered pain or when he suffered his dystonia, how far back did that set them? Was that a big risk, that as soon as they've experienced that slight bit of pain, which mimics what they had before on a smaller scale, did that sort of set them right back or destroy their confidence in what was going on?
No, it was, I suppose it could have destroyed their confidence. I mean, that's the main risk. But that's where your relationship has to be kind of a very nurturing one, in that we're going to push this boundary and we're going to try and it's going to still be there. I'm expecting it to be there. It will be there by definition, but slowly it will be different, hopefully. So to answer the question, you didn't have a loss of all the gains we've made. It wasn't like a house of cards, but we'd back away quite quickly, because I think, and this is all theoretical, of course, but I think that if you persist in, I'm just going to persist, we've got this fun, I'm just going to persist, I'm just going to do the golf swing, I'm going to go through the pain, I think what you're doing there is you're going back to the what caused it in the first place. You are going back down that pathway, which is an unhelpful pathway, either be that a pain or a movement which, or a technique which you haven't got quite right, which you want to try and stay away from. You don't want to go down that road, you want to go down the other roads you've built.
One of our questioners asked whether, since they were unlikely, they felt to see someone with focal dystonia in their clinic, what you've been talking about was applicable to other people. Of course, you've now talked about using your approach to a sports person. But someone else has said, well, you know, is it applicable to treating other conditions such as, say, frozen shoulder?
Ooh, frozen shoulder's a tricky one.
Yeah, I think somebody must have picked that one just to throw a real spanner into the works there.
As far as I was last aware with frozen shoulder, they're not always 100% sure as to exactly why the 18 months happens, the 6 months of pain, then immobility, and then recovery. Certainly the ones I've seen, there's not a lot of movement there, and I'm not sure whether it's going to be as applicable to apply this. But what I would say is that it's worth a try. I would say that it's worth a try with most things. But it's probably not as applicable as something that we know has a neural content. If we find that frozen shoulder has a neural content, then yes. And in terms of the patterns that you've got yourself into with a frozen shoulder, or shall we say an immobilized leg, for instance, then I think it's certainly worth considering the neurological component and what's happening there. Because with a frozen shoulder, if you're right hand dominant, you're going to be wasting there in terms of muscular, but you're also going to be wasting in the sensory homunculus for your arm and shoulder and your hand, because you're not moving it. So as well as the wastage here locally, you're wasting, and the maps of movement for your arm have defacilitated and wasted away. They're not as defined anymore. The homunculus, if you did something, we will do things with our hands, but the homunculus representation of your hand is going to be very much less defined than it was before. So I would suggest that elements of the approach are applicable, yes. So visualization of moving that arm, visualization of tactile, fine dexterity moves with your fingers and hand, absolutely, from an early point. Because when your arm does eventually release off and magically come back to use, you're going to have the use on a musculoskeletal level, although needing rehab, but you're going to also need to rehab very quickly those maps in the nervous system. And if you don't or haven't visualized it, or at least gone through some kind of sort of sensory input, then I would say that your actual route back to full function is going to be much longer.
Have you become a bit of an expert in exercise therapy now? Because I never feel that osteopaths, through their basic training, are much good at exercises, unlike physios who spend a lot more time on it. But it strikes me that you've developed exercises rather than taking them out of a box and saying, oh, this is what we do for back pain. You've thought, well, you've been thinking out of that box. You've been thinking, well, what would be appropriate in this dysfunctional state?
I come from a background in strength and conditioning. Yeah. Initially in the services as a physical training officer. So for me, it's quite a natural transition. There is a huge grey area which exists between the clinic and where we inhabit and strength and conditioning for sports or whatever. So there's a grey area in there, which I think is an area where there's some potential for people who want to be a bit more confident in actually engaging with strength and conditioning coaches and vice versa, and trying to put something together which actually ticks all the boxes. So from my perspective, I've always been very interested in how to increase the ability for a function to be fulfilled. So in the services, in sport, in music, and breaking, I've been used to breaking things down. So for me, I'm very naturally inhabit that gray area between the sports conditioning and the clinical world. I worked with a rugby team, as I mentioned to you, I think, briefly, and they wanted me to put together something that stopped them getting injured because there's a lot of spontaneous injury happening. And so that's called prehab, prehabilitation. And it's a grey area as to who it is, who inhabits that world, who has the role of prehab.
Well, I normally associate it with what is conventionally a physiotherapy approach to treating people before surgery.
Exactly.
So that they are better conditioned to accept the surgery that is inevitably going to cause muscle wastage and sensory deficit and so on.
Yeah, that's
so
exactly where...
You're treating people who are not going for... Well, they're going for trauma, not for surgery.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's certainly rugby, yeah. That's exactly right. But you can prehab someone for any function. Yeah. And I think you can, you know, in certainly coming back to a general clinic, the elderly population that we see, you know, what comes first? When someone falls or has a history of falling, what comes first, the muscle wastage or the neurological detraining? Because if they feel a bit wobbly, they'll sit down. If they sit down, they'll detrain. They stand up and feel weak and fall. So it's chicken and egg. So this is what I said initially, that I like to give neural exercises and balance exercises to most people. Yeah. Because there is that plasticity, even in the elderly, that they can adapt and respond and improve balance. And that is prehab, as is with an elite athlete, that you're prehabbing them. So with those guys, you work very much on embedding neurological aspects of human function into their training strategies. Yeah. So for instance, slowing things down. There was a three-stage process where the initial thing was, right, you want to run faster without having spontaneous Achilles rupture or hamstring rupture, then what have you been doing before that's causing this? And, you know, so again, you had to treat the team like an individual and say, well, what's the history of the team? And something I'm sure a lot of the viewers will recognise is that with elite sport, what you sometimes get is a specialist in speed who comes in and coaches in sprinting technique, and, you know, you can very quickly get someone running faster. But it's akin to putting a go faster chip into a saloon without upgrading the suspension and the brakes. You're going to have a problem, because if you're going 20% faster, eventually those increased forces and loads are going to take their toll somewhere. So you have spontaneous ruptures and stress fractures.
How did you get on with treating hamstrings? Because I remember looking into this a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, and there was a lot of debate over actually when a hamstring injury occurs. Is it when it's under concentric contraction or eccentric contraction? In other words, when it's slowing the leg down rather than actually developing power.
Yeah, I think there's, well, I think both. Certainly how I went around developing something that, not just hamstring, but Achilles. There seemed to be over tendency for people to get stress fractures as well. And I think the common factor was a lot of the coaching that had been happening. So what I'm a great believer in, you know, giving people the right advice, but not until they're ready. So similarly to the individuals, you don't want to give them stuff that's going to potentially overload the system. So slow it down first. An American football coach, who I respect greatly, has great success with his athletes because the first thing he does is slow them down. And his byline is, you know, don't speed it up until you can perfect it slowly. And that, when you break down what you're doing by perfecting, say, for instance, a single leg kind of hitch on an exercise bench, is breaking down the running movement into a movement which the brain recognizes and which can be perfected slowly. And it's harder to do it slowly. And only when you can perfect the technique slowly and under control will you move on to the next level, which is to put a bit more speed and a bit more tempo into it. Because by that way, you're not only upgrading the high-performance chip, but you're also upgrading the brakes and the tyres and the frame that goes with it.
Do you think this plasticity of the homunculus varies significantly with age? Is there likely to be a cut-off age for the effectiveness of your approach? We're talking about elderly people.
Yeah, aren't you? I think there is always room for change and adaptation. I think it's well known in the sources that are there that learning a new skill, if that's what we're going to call it, slows up as you age. But I certainly think there's adaptability and plasticity whilst you're alive. But it does slow. The regeneration processes in the whole body slow, and this is included in that. You know, if we were to try and learn a language or an instrument at age 12, it would be a lot quicker to do it than when we were age 80. But you could still do it, and you wouldn't probably ever master it. But I think in terms of, you know, if we're going to talk specifically about an elderly population, then simple balance exercises, I think, are well worth trying because it's not that complex. Or dentures, I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely.
Standing on one leg while your dentures are in a jar, that's not the same thing, is it?
Absolutely. Yeah. But I think it's a good question. I think whilst we live, there is.
I'm half serious. I mean, what balance exercises would you give to your elderly patients then? How would you challenge
them? In a very safe environment, I would get them, again, you have to have something that you can hold on to if you have got a slight wobble problem. But just standing. And if you're not used to standing, first of all, that's the question. I mean, it's, again, you have to grade it, so it's difficult to answer a general question. But if someone can stand, but they feel wobbly, then just trying to, I think there wouldn't be any harm in just trying to increase the time they're actually standing. Yes. If they do have a problem and they do feel wobbly, you have to be respectful of that. And what I would say is if there's a reason behind that, so blood pressure or something, then obviously you have to go through the case history with them first. But if it seems to be some kind of confidence stroke neurological detraining, which is weaken the muscles, then certainly the physiotherapy world are very confident in this, and they'll get people up and they'll get them doing specific balance exercises, one leg, sort of shifting the weight from one leg to another whilst, you know, with safety equipment around them. Very simple things are just standing up from a chair and then holding that, maybe one leg, then the other, and then coming back down in a controlled way is a start. If someone isn't standing up, just the simple act of leaning forward and coming up, it's gonna help with, and just doing that as a kind of exercise, it's gonna help with strength and exercising the muscles, etc. But it's also gonna help with coordination. It's the first step, and then the next step would then be working with them to actually stand them up. But what I would say is that this is always taken better as prevention. You know, and I think that as osteopaths or physiotherapists working in primary healthcare, anyone above the age of 55 should be thinking about some form of balance exercise, and B, maybe brain training that does it for them. But you know, just some stuff that actually gets them engaging. I mean, I get some of my people to start to take up novel exercise. Generally, a bit of table tennis is fantastic because, you know, you're moving around, and you're balancing, you're coordinating. Certainly, in terms of some of the more novel approaches I've taken with immobilized athletes, I'm trying to get them to utilize their nervous system in novel ways. I get them to, if they have to sit, I get them to visualize a time in their life when they were performing at the top of their game. And I get them to then get silk handkerchiefs and juggle across the midline as they're visualizing it. That takes some doing. Also, one particular
Juggling silk handkerchiefs.
Yeah, across like this. Another individual who had some great success with, I got him to actually learn the drums, again, because it's kind of as about as dexterity, it's about as manual dexterity as you can get. And I've had actually great success with children. We had to change the subject completely, but with children, dyspraxia, dyslexia. Not only, I think, does it engage them on a level that they enjoy, but it also, I think, kind of works into that primitive reflex thing we touched upon earlier, that cross-crawl thing that we see in development of a child who's crawling. Certainly, I think, you know, getting a child or an adult to revisit some of those, so we say, evolutionary movements is always a good thing, until I'm proved wrong, I suppose.
I'm going to sort of, these are slightly out of context because I've been collecting these questions as you've been talking, and certainly somebody's picked up on the Ale Lederman connection here, because they've said, what are your thoughts on core stability?
Oh, okay.
Ale is a great, is very dismissive of core stability in its own, as a single therapeutic.
Was that recently?
Ale.
About
2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
I should be clear there. Ale's not dismissive of core stability. He says his research shows that core stability is no more advantageous than any other form of exercise in preventing or overcoming back pain.
So in relation to back pain?
Yes. Yeah. But your thoughts?
I would, from a movement perspective, to create a function, to get from A to B for a specific role, or, you know, if we take breaking it down to a function for life or a function for sport or performance, and let's say life is the performance, isn't it? I would err on the side that you need core stability. I don't think we need to focus to the nth degree on core, but you need it.
Yes, and I think...
Jimmy, is the question more tipped towards as a therapeutic intervention?
Well, I think so. It simply says, what are your thoughts on core stability?
I would say not to ignore it.
Yeah. I think, and again, I don't want to put my words into Ale's mouth, but my understanding of Ale Lederman's approach here is that you are training your core whenever you are doing whatever activity it is that you want to do.
Yeah.
It's much more useful to you if you want to learn to stand up from a chair, to stand up from the chair rather than do sit-ups on a Swiss ball, which makes you very good at sit-ups on a Swiss ball.
To that extent, I agree. Yeah. I agree with that. And certainly, from a personal perspective, if I'm training, or from a perspective if I'm training a performer, it would be a functional movement.
Yes.
That you've broken down. So coming back to the rugby team, the movements that I got them doing were multi-directional, because it's a multi-directional sport. And the movements I got them doing were focused upon lower leg stability and dynamic movement. Dynamic movement needs core. There was a little bit of core in it, but by definition, to go up and over one side of a block that is this big, you need your core. Mm-hmm. But I didn't particularly focus on the core. You need the core to be firing and working on that. And actually, arguably, if there's an imbalance, if there is an under-training in the core, then you could argue that, you know, you're more predisposed. It's probably an argument and an interesting aside that will rumble on.
Well, I've asked Ale a number of times to come and talk on one of his broadcasts about core stability, because he is a very entertaining lecturer and he likes a challenge. And he's resisting the opportunity to come and talk to us about core stability. But I will keep the pressure on, and it will be interesting to hear his view. And I think he would probably, once again, he would probably say that actually, yes, you do need your core muscles, if there is such a thing as a core, to be functioning when you do that exercise. But you're training them to do the exercise by doing the exercise rather than doing sit-ups on a Swiss ball.
It's interesting because, I mean, in terms of physical conditioning, in the last 30 years, it's gone full circle. Certainly, when I was in the services, the gyms were basically ropes to climb, wooden horses to jump over, and, you know, you're making human pyramids with people. You know, that was basically the training, but I've never been fitter.
Yes.
I've never been fitter, and the training was based around the fact you're using the equipment, you know, for hours on end, the heavy equipment that you need to use. Yeah. Now, interestingly, then it became, how high-tech can a gym be? So it became high-tech. Now you go to somewhere like a CrossFit gym, and there are ropes to climb, there are tires to flip, and there are and there are sledgehammers to hit tyres with. So it's become really functional.
Yes.
And certainly, I know that some of the rugby teams on an international level that are known to be fitter. Yes, they do a lot of weight training, but they do a lot of functional stuff as well. They do a lot of functional specific training. Yeah. So it's come full circle.
Yeah. This, again, is not relevant to what we're saying, but I'm aware of a very elite bunch of performers who made a massive difference in their own gymnasium when the lead instructor made them take all the mirrors out.
Okay.
They stopped worrying about whether they looked good on the beach and got on with training for the task instead.
Okay.
Because, you know, there's an argument about the modern form of exercise, isn't there, that it's Charles Atlas stuff. It's all, let's make our pecs look big rather than be good at doing a function.
Yeah.
Let's leave that aside. I want to go back
to... That's a shame.
Somebody on our audience wants us to go back to treating the elderly patient. They have said that their biggest issue is getting the elderly to believe that they can still make changes because they're of a generation where they've had it drilled into them that society will do things for them at that age. Is that something you've encountered, or how do you overcome it?
I think the very fact that if they've come to see you...
But they're wanting you to do it for them.
Yeah, that's the difficulty, in that I think we have all become a little bit guilty of falling into that comfort zone where a patient comes to see you, you're the expert, help me. Yeah. And sometimes it's difficult to say, well, I can help you by giving you the right advice, by acting as a gatekeeper to... the right book or the right activity that you can do. That is the challenge, I think, moving forward. But I think certainly it's something that's a reoccurring theme in the research that I do, is that we have become acknowledged for being peddlers of very effective, you know, back pain management, manipulation, oscillation, mobilization, you name it, soft tissue work, which is all done to a patient. I think certainly it's a bit one-dimensional. I think we can have more effect by being a bit more proactive and progressive. That might take time, and the viewer said that maybe it's a generational thing. I think it might take that long for things to change, in that we can start integrating a practice and being guides, as well as dealing with, you know, acute pain and chronic pain, but maybe doing it in a bit more of a progressive way.
But it will be interesting to see the changes in patients' attitudes, as we're constantly told, an increasingly elderly population now. And I don't know, some might argue that people nowadays are even more used to having things done for them. They expect to go to the doctor and get a pill to fix it, or to the osteopath and get a crack to fix it, or they go to the physio and they give them an exercise which fixes it. But they don't have to continue to do anything, which leads on to another one of the questions, which is, do you expect your patients to continue with the exercises that you've given them to prevent future injury? Now, I've got an
image
here of Mike standing on one leg cleaning his teeth for the rest of his life.
I saw Mike today, this morning, in practice.
Was he cleaning his teeth?
But we revise every now and then. So, yeah, it depends on the individual and what they're going through in their lives. You might get, there might be a slight regression and you have to do a revision. So it does become quite an intense relationship in terms of the interaction, and certainly your availability to them, and that is often off-putting, I think, to general practice, isn't it? In that, you know, you need to get people in, see them, and then see the next person, and this creates more work. That is the downside to this side of things. It's a bit more of a labour-intensive interaction, and it can be ongoing, not in all cases.
Do you find that focal dystonics use sensory trickery, that is, applying pressure to the affected spasm, as is often found in dystonics, and do you use this phenomenon in your treatment approach?
Sensory trickery?
Yes. Applying pressure to the affected spasm.
Okay, that's interesting. I would certainly not, I mean, I don't want to give the impression that all I do is stand back and say, do this, do that, do that. I do get my hands on.
Yes.
And have done that, because you have to. And certainly there's an argument, having said everything I've said, for good old-fashioned, you know, passive mobilisation, because that, again, is sending positive information, as well as loosening things on a local level. It's sending positive information on a proprioceptive level. Sensory trickery, I would say, I mean, I've used what we call K-tape in the sporting world, so kinesio tape, on a local area. So you would... for instance, on a sacroiliac joint or on a specific spinal level here, for Mike, for instance, as a case, I would put kinesio tape initially. So in that respect, it's a constant. I'll give them enough to have moving forward, and then ask them, you know, suggest them they get their own supply eventually. Yeah.
It's expensive, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Mm. But initially, it was helpful in raising the dermatomal awareness. Mm-hmm. Even little things like that, I think, that chatter we talked about, can actually, I think, theoretically, increase the chatter. And again, it does come under the term sensory trick, I think, because it is. You've got to try and fool that pain gate, if you want to call it that, on a segmental level, or the fright or flight response. Actually, there's nothing to be frightened of here. I can feel sensation coming back here, and it's not hurting me. And if they haven't been doing that before, then it's actually quite a useful thing to do.
Yeah. You mentioned the pain gate, and there's some similarity in what you've just said to what I understand as the pain gate mechanism, which is providing a low-level painful stimulus to shut off a greater painful stimulus using the pain fiber pathways. But what you seem to suggest with the kinesio tape is that actually you're giving the skin, the body a proprioceptive response. It's just giving it an awareness of something.
Yeah, well, for me, it's one and the same. Mm. In that any information ascending, which is non-provocative, can help.
So why do you use kinesio tape rather than elastic bandage?
It's just so easy to use. I've used it pitch side, and you're done in seconds and you're on. It's waterproof, it's functional, and it breathes, etc. It's just good stuff.
Yeah. Well, we're going to do a session on taping, in particular kinesio taping.
Oh, great.
Because that'd be interesting to... I don't know the science behind it, and I imagine there has to be some science behind it for it to gather popularity the way it has.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly used it... I usually use more static stuff when you're doing certain taping techniques, pitch side, but it's certainly... I like it because... you can do it in such a way, if someone has had an injury, often the K-tape will act as an emotional crutch. Mm. And a lot of rugby players go through a regime, if you like, a ritual. You've probably seen it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And part of that is getting taped.
There are many rituals before a sport.
Before sport, performance, yeah, absolutely.
Which are very important in terms of establishing your confidence levels and so on.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of sport, I'm really pleased to read this question because it is an observation. Practicing slow, highly accurate and repetitive sequences in the martial arts can provide huge benefits in control of movement. And this viewer knows of many Japanese sword practitioners, over 70, who have perfect control of their stability. And is this related to your approach? And the only reason I'm really pleased with this question is because apparently it's come from someone who's actually watching us in Japan, where it's 3 o'clock in the morning. So good morning to you in Japan.
Good morning.
great to have you on board. But does it relate to what you do?
I think
fine control of movement?
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of the theory that I talk about, you know, is based in these truisms, you know, that when things that kind of instinctually make sense, don't they? That if you can perfect something slowly, then if you have to speed it up, you'll have control. So absolutely, it's the same, yeah.
Okay. I want to go back to something you and I discussed before we actually came in here, which was the barriers to entry into the sporting arena for osteopaths. I mean, you had some opinions about that, didn't you?
Born from some personal experience of it, in that often if a job in elite sport is advertised, it'll be advertised sports therapy or physiotherapy. And I'm not saying that that's wrong, but what I'm saying is that the language around elite sports has often been that they understand the world of the physio or the sports therapist, and so they will go with that. And so I did start to feel, and certainly some of my peers in the Osteopathic Sports Care Association have often personally experienced it as a bit of a glass ceiling. You get so far and you can't get in at all. When you actually do get a foothold in and you learn the language of the people around you, as in the language of the medics and the physiotherapists, they learn your language and see what you do. There's so much crossover. Yeah. So certainly, as an undergrad, I would say that when you qualify as an osteopath, you are as qualified and as able to do to work with sports people as an undergrad physiotherapy student would be. Mm-hmm. There's only a few universities in the UK that actually give any kind of undergraduate hands-on pitch side training, only one or two. Yeah. And you know, those are great. But certainly,
I was going to ask, do you think pitch side is the place for an osteopath? Because pitch side tends to be it's more first aid treatment rather than rehabilitation or prehab, isn't it?
Yes, that's a good point you make. I mean, it is a bit cut and thrust. Mm. You know, I love it because it's it's you know, it's kind of quite immediate. The immediacy of the situation, you have to triage it, and not everyone has a skill set to do that. But then pitch side also include as the tent on the side of the pitch or the treatment room on the side of the pitch is when the real work starts.
Yeah.
So you make sure they're safe, obviously, first, and then they go into the treatment room, which is what I include in pitch side.
Okay.
Absolutely include that. And I think that is a place for an osteopath in a multidisciplinary team. Yeah. I've worked with a great group of physiotherapists with the England Touch Rugby squad over some years, and probably learnt more working with them on, you know, when you're at international events than you have in months and months and months and months of practice.
Yeah.
Because you see what people are doing. It's a very enriching, enlivening experience. And certainly your skills and your outlook as an osteopath aren't undervalued once you have their confidence. The key is, though, to have their confidence. And I think to have the confidence of the people who make the decisions in sports medicine is the key. So with OSCAR, what we're trying to hopefully launch this year is a new membership structure which is recognisable to the people who make decisions in sports medicine. So
maybe we should get OSCAR to come on one of these podcasts and talk about what OSCAR's doing so that we can, I mean, there are lots of osteopaths who want to get into this realm, aren't there?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, we could talk a little bit now if you like about it. But so the new structure will be recognisable to, for instance, a team manager or, you know, to the British Olympic Association who have had experience of working with physiotherapists in sport.
Mm.
So the Chartered Association of Physiotherapists in Sport have level 1, 2 and 3, which dictates the hours of relevant pitch side or event experience with elite athletes.
Mm-hmm. Is there training involvement or is it just hours of...
They have to provide documentation and a portfolio.
Yeah.
Certain levels of postgraduate specialist education in some sort of sports or therapy-related rehab degree or diploma. And then, so for instance, with OSCAR, we have that and we have the years you've been qualified as well. So we have three ways of actually gaining points, which give you then entry into level 1, 2 and 3. We won't make any bones about it. It's done so it's recognisable and familiar.
Yeah.
And it's a very similar system. And we hope that what that will do is that when we get more people to actually engage with that, that when jobs are advertised, so for instance with the Olympic Games, Commonwealth Games, people to work with the Institute of Sport, people to work with Premiership football or rugby teams, or with individuals, they will have experience of a physio who's a level 1 or 2 or 3.
Mm.
And then also then see, osteopath level 2, 1, 2 or 3. The hope being that they'll then understand what we do.
Are you meeting any resistance to that in terms of osteopaths who don't want to see the profession segregated in that way to say you're a better osteopath than me because you're level 1?
I think it's a good question because I think it's a debate that's currently happening, certainly with the Osteopathic Development Group, with the IO, that's certainly looking into that very question. There's a working group who I'm not part of, but certainly I think that I'll be very interested to see what they come up with. There's a lot of people there who've been osteopath a lot longer than me who will come up with probably other suggestions. But I personally think that, for instance, I would engage with that process myself and try to get into a level, be that a level 2 or 3, whatever it is that it's deemed that I'm going to be a membership of. And but I wouldn't call myself a sports osteopath. I'll call myself an osteopath who has relevant experience and expertise in that area. It's not to say that I wouldn't be interested in treating anyone else who came.
Yeah, and I suppose we don't argue about people who may have gone and done various levels of cranial training at the Sutherland Institute, for example. It's perfectly acceptable to be at a different grade in a specific area, which maybe brings us on to the idea of specialisation. Is specialisation a good thing? Is it good to be a sports osteopath, which you don't regard yourself as? Is it good to be a paediatric osteopath, or should we all stick with just being osteopaths?
That is the question, isn't it? I certainly think there's a middle ground. I think you can be an osteopath and you can be have a level of expertise which is recognisable to the people who want your help, be that a sports team or a mother with a baby. I mean, certainly the other argument is, are you a paediatric osteopath? They're not protected titles. Osteopath is, and I think that won't change. But certainly, I know that the IO, the certainly the direction of travel is towards royal chartership. And I think, you know, part of that will probably be showing evidence for levels of expertise within that. So if we all want to go on that journey with them as a profession, I think things inevitably will change.
This will probably be our final question, and I suspect it's probably come from our viewer in Japan again. It says, what are your thoughts on the Feldenkrais approach, which also uses visualization and works with the nervous system to change habitual patterns? I only say that because Feldenkrais was a big judo practitioner. But
yeah, again, not massively familiar. I'm familiar with the concept. Yeah, very positive. I mean, there's what you'll find is if you listen back to what I've said tonight, you'll think, oh, yeah, that will probably resonate with certain things and other things. It's not unique to what the reading I've done. The things I've been saying have been drawn from the reading I've done, and there's a lot of commonality out there. Historically, moving back, there's a lot of commonality to do with on an evolutionary process, working with your nervous system in a very functional way that nourishes it. You know, we haven't invented that. It's been around. That's why we're both here. It's been around for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So there will be a lot of commonality in a lot of different approaches, because we all share the nervous system, so there's bound to be.
Yeah. Okay. I think the one thing, one last question from me, as opposed to from our audience, where would you say that one of our viewers should start in terms of developing the approach that you've been using with the patients that you have?
Sure.
Because you've given us some really good insights into what you've done, but faced with that unexpected patient in our clinic,
right,
it'd be a little bit difficult to say, well, we're going to make you stand on one leg and clean your teeth.
Yeah, of course.
So where would they start to be able to develop this? Well, it's a holistic approach, which of course we pride ourselves on, but to go down the route that you've been talking about.
Well, I suppose I could just give the example of what happened to me. And I had to revisit my undergrad notes. I had to revisit my neurology notes. I had to then start reading. And a lot of the reading I did was, you know, it was quite academic and quite full-on journalistic, medical journals. What I would say is some fantastic books out there that are quite digestible. There is a book called The Talent Code by a gentleman whose surname is Coyle, C-O-Y-L-E.
We will put the references up on the website.
And there's also a book by Norman Doidge, who's currently on the bestseller list, I think, who's works in neuroplasticity, mm-hmm. and gives some really interesting examples of what I've talked about today. They're good starting points.
Okay.
The brain that changes itself. There's also some stuff on YouTube, I think, of him being interviewed, which is really, really stuff that you can engage with on a very easy level. So that's a good starting point.
Okay, good. And I'm sure everybody's itching to know, how well did Sue get on? Did she get back to top-level golf?
She's playing again.
Okay.
Without paying. Whether she gets back to top-level golf is yet to be seen.
But she's playing, so that's
she's playing.
That's fantastic.
For me, that's a result.
Yeah. This has been brilliant. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about this. I'm sure there's a load more that you could tell us, a load more that we could go on with, and we probably will come back and talk more about Oscar, whether with you or someone else from Oscar, at some time in the future. Ladies and gentlemen, I feel this has been one of our really good broadcasts this evening, because it's taking those osteopaths in the audience back to, you know, the foundations of what we do, this holistic approach, and it's done it in a very, very convincing and, I think, encouraging way. It's fired us up again, as it were. For those who aren't osteopaths, you know, this isn't a unique approach. Everyone's holistic, and what we've learned today is eminently usable in clinic. So, yeah, it's been a really good evening. Once again, it's been a pleasure having so many people from around the world watching this evening. It's been a great evening, and hopefully we'll see you next week when we talk about electrotherapy with Tim Watson.